Hold on.
That is not going through my microphone now.
Yes, but it seems to be going through it several times because I hear you.
I mean, this is going to be the cross chatter from the problem is Sam's headphones are not designed to.
They're wireless, so I can go far away.
Can you? Bluetooth has a pretty low rate. Why don't we just join the call?
What about this? I'm going to lock myself in your bathroom, Shishon. How's this working?
Sam, I can't hear you, and you can't hear me.
I can hear you, Sean.
Or myself. So
I can hear you.
Hi, Sean.
Hi, Derek.
Hi, Sam.
Hi, Derek. Hi, Sean.
So, Sam, for a couple months, you've been periodically asking, when am I coming back on the podcast? And then you showed up at my house with a microphone.
Yep.
Demanding to be let on the podcast. So, sure. Presumably you have something incredibly pressing.
Well, I mean, I think there's a lesson here. The lesson is if you want to come on the podcast, you have to find where Sean lives.
And show up with a microphone.
Bring your own microphone. That we can't configure. And then you get to just record it from Sean's bedroom. It's fine.
I actually have a programming topic that I think we can talk about. So I recently released the RFC for how I'd like to change aspects versioning to sort of more closely mirror Rails, because for a long time now, RSpec Rails specifically has supported Rails 3 upward, and that is becoming incredibly unsustainable now. So the basics of my proposal are that RSpec will track Rails versions, and every time a Rails version gets released, we'll drop a major if we need to drop Rails versions.
Hmm.
And I don't know if either of you have read it, but I really want to drop support for Ruby 1.8.6 and Rails 3. And
wait, you support 1.8.6? Not even just 1.8.7, you support 1.8.6?
No, sorry, yes, 1.8.7.
Okay. I do think that it is actively harmful is maybe a little stronger than I intend, but I do think it is bad for end-of-life software to continue to be supported by other libraries.
Sure.
Well, were you talking specifically about RSpec Rails or RSpec as a whole?
RSpec Rails. And actually, okay. Part of the RFC is taking RSpec Rails' versioning out of lockstep with RSpec the rest of its versioning, so that the version numbers will actually mean different things.
I think that piece of it makes sense on its own, no matter what, because RSpec Rails presumably needs to get bumped whenever Rails gets bumped and not necessarily whenever RSpec gets bumped.
Yes.
Yeah, that part makes sense. And I'm inclined to agree with Sean that like continuing to support old versions on newer versions of RSpec, like, I'm trying to come up with a scenario where you would be stuck on an old version of Ruby or Rails and need to have the latest version of RSpec in order to continue to successfully work. Like, in general, I applaud the idea that old versions of developer tools in particular continue to support old versions of software, but at some point there comes a time where the cost of that support is too high, even if it's not incredibly high, like, code-wise, just having to, like, it's incredibly high, like, running the test suite against 27,000 different versions and things like that.
Yes. That actually is my core motivation, is that I would like to be able to deliver RSpec Rails features in less than, like, a 1.5 hour CI run. And the reason it takes that long is because we have to run against all Rails versions higher than 3 and all Ruby interpreters higher than 1.8.7, right? So it's, like, a 95-minute Travis build or something.
Yeah, I can empathize with that a little bit. I mean, I maintain stuff that supports back to 1.9.2, I think.
Sure.
And from Rails 3.0 or 3, I think 3.1, maybe 3.0, all the way up to today. But that's not nearly the same matrix and also not used by nearly the same amount of people.
Which of your gems is this?
Clearance.
Sure. Is there any reason for clearance to still support Rails 3?
No, there's no reason, and it just becomes more and more ridiculous as we go on. The reason is, like, right. I want to bump the major version once and not twice, but I really should probably just go ahead and bump the major version with just the removal of, like, old code, and then maybe also, like, there's a bunch of weirdness in how users get created because I have to support a scenario where you may have, what's the old way of protecting against mass assignment?
Attributes. Yeah.
Yeah. Adder accessible. Yeah. Yes, adder you may have like adder yeah. accessible, or you may have strong parameters. So instead of doing either one of those things, I do like actual assignments, and it causes people problems when they want to customize what happens.
Why don't you just pull in strong parameters as a gem?
Yeah.
Would that even work with, well, whatever. Any, either way, I'm just going, I think the very next thing I have on my list of things that I would like to do is to just like, I've been kind of neglecting clearance because I'm not entertained by it right now. But I need to get back to it and like fix a few bugs that have come up that people really want fixed and probably go ahead and release a 2.0 version that like lessens the maintenance burden by getting rid of as much deprecated stuff as I can.
I will say, my intent was to literally just release a version of RSpec where all that changes is the Travis.yaml, and it's like, 3.2 is not supported anymore, surprise, right?
Mm-hmm. I've had conversations with Caleb about that too, specifically with regards to Scenic, and he was like, I don't want to support these anymore. He wasn't thinking like, I don't want to support it as in like, this gem won't install, but as in like, right. We won't run it on CI, and therefore it is unsupported. Like, if it doesn't work,
right.
Sorry. But yeah. I don't know. I kind of feel like if you're not supporting it, you should not allow it to run. It's different for a development tool than something that runs at runtime, I feel like.
Right.
So like if the development tool doesn't
work. Y'all know what David wants gems to start doing, right? With versioning?
No. What does he want?
He wants gems to stop putting an upper bound on their Rails dependency.
Yeah, I'm cool with that. I've stopped doing that a long time ago.
Really?
Yeah. It's like if you try and update Rails and it breaks, then like... I mean, it depends. I guess it depends on the gem.
Well, I mean, this is no different than, I mean, this is, you were just arguing that if you don't support it, it shouldn't run, and therefore you should bump your lowest supported version. That was what you just said a second ago. How is this any different?
I just feel like it's a little bit, I guess it's not on a sufficiently old enough new release of Rails, but on like a brand new, like if on day one you upgrade to a new version of Rails and you're able to install this gem and it doesn't work, you're not exactly surprised, right? It's not like, oh, okay, well... There's probably an issue.
Don't
in Rails
necessarily
5
know what gem it is.
It's true. Yeah.
So I will say with Rails 5.2, so RSpec Rails does not put an upper bound on the Rails version installs. And so when 5.2 got released, I was like, does this actually work? And the answer is mostly yes. There is one deprecation warning that gets printed inside your green dots, which we should probably fix. And there was one test that I had to fix in RSpec Rails, but like none of the production code changed. And so that's like really cool, right? And that's a really good argument to not put that upper band there.
Well, I mean, and that's really cool when that is what happens, but that could also just as easily have been like, you did that. Oh, cool. It works. Release a new patch version with the increased upper band. Because the problem is when things break, because we live in a Ruby world where everything is monkey patching everything and interacting in all sorts of strange ways, instead of it being that, you know, this gem only supports up to 5.1, it could just be some failure that looks like it's from Active Record, but is actually caused by one of three gems that are not updated.
Sure. And I'm in the lucky position where my code doesn't run in production, so I don't have to worry about it.
I do think that there's, like, I'm trying to think through the times where I try and upgrade a major version of Rails or even a minor version of Rails on client projects and things like that. And I feel like I more often run into the issue where I can't successfully update because somebody has unnecessarily restricted a Rails version than I run into the issue where I can't successfully upgrade because the gem doesn't work with the new version of Rails. The former is really like, it's because there's a lot of gems out there that are just like really small gems that don't do a ton and they don't like monkey patch anything. They don't like... I'm trying to think of an example right now, but off the top of my head, it's the long tail of gems, right? It's not the RSpec. It's this gem is used by a few thousand people kind of thing,
right?
Where the maintainer isn't actively doing anything anymore, really, except merging patches when new versions of Rails come out that say like, hey, you've got to update this.
Yeah.
I still think that there's a lot of use though in the specific feedback of when a gem has been confirmed to work with a given version of Rails. Like, this seems like it could be more easily solved by a feature in Ruby gems or Bundler, like gem whatever YOLO true.
Right. And I think that I don't remember what Mix calls it, or Hex is the Elixir one. There's a way to say like force true. Like, that's the YOLO option where you can say like, I know it's going to think that it shouldn't install on this version, but go ahead. You can do that.
Interesting. And how often
those are all
bite
those
you?
Would still be looked at things. I don't know how often it bites me. I don't do enough Elixir right now to say, but like it's been useful because I don't have to fork the project, point at my GitHub fork, and then submit the patch and things like that. But I still want to do that. It's still a thing that would bother me. Like if I had to do that in my gem file where I said like force true or YOLO true or whatever it was,
But at least then it's something that you opt into and not just stuff breaks and good luck trying to figure it out.
I guess the other thing is you could flag a single gem as YOLO,
right?
And then Bundler could work out.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was talking about. You do that on the specific single package level.
This discussion is actually extremely relevant to my life because I am currently in process of upgrading the last Rails 3.2 application at DigitalOcean to like something modern. And once I
something
finally
modern,
got
like 4.1.
No, it's Phoenix.
We're going to start with 4.0. but no, once I like finally resolved all the gem conflicts, right? I typed like bundle and it's just sat there grinding for a handful of minutes while it's like finally resolving all of these dependencies. Because, like, that's a hard problem.
It's NP hard.
Right. Anyway, the point I was sort of making is that, like, doing all of those conflict resolutions, I don't know how many of those were necessary, right? And even though 3.2 is now long dead, like, did I really need to upgrade the, like, concurrency gem or, like, I18N? Like, who knows?
Well, I mean, that gets down into more of the fundamental differences between, like, you know, in Rust or Node, where those are internal dependencies, you can just have multiple versions, no problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I still don't think anybody's actually quite solved this issue perfectly, because then the flip side of that is if you have two external dependencies that get resolved to different versions, and then in Node, potentially things blow up, or in Rust, your code just won't compile.
Right.
There are, like, specifically, Sam mentioned, like, the I18N gem getting updated when you update other gems. There's actually a flag that I learned about in Bundler when you run, like, if you run bundle update Rails or whatever. By default, if multiple things in your gem file depend on, I think it's if they have shared dependencies, so I guess if they both depend on Rails, then those dependencies mm-hmm. get re-resolved as well, which may get you an updated version of those gems. But if you pass the conservative flag, it does not allow shared dependencies to get updated. So it tries to just update the gem that you passed it.
So like if I bundle update Rails --conservative, it will like only update Rails and things that immediately transient from that nothing else depends on.
Yes, exactly. So if you have two things in your app that depend on I18N, that won't get updated.
I wish I had known about this.
Right. It comes in handy when you like run the first thing without --conservative, and something breaks. And so you're like, oh, I guess I need to add a restriction in my gem file to like this I18N gem or whatever the case may be. I probably wouldn't have been I18N, but something, I'm trying to remember like SAS. SAS Rails was giving us problems.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, you don't need to actually add a specific constraint on SAS Rails. You can just bundle update --conservative and you'll be okay.
Yeah.
Or whatever the case may be. It was something that wouldn't have appeared in your gem file. SAS Rails probably does, but.
Yeah. I was just mostly impressed that like, this bundle took like a good 4 or 5 minutes to resolve, and then I was reminded, as Sean pointed out, this is a really hard unsolved problem in computer science.
One of the other things that really bothers me when it comes to Rails upgrades is that Bundler will totally let you resolve a version of the PG, MySQL, or SQLite gems that are completely incompatible with the version of Rails that you're using.
That's because Rails doesn't have a way to specify an optional dependency, right?
Right. So it's nowhere in any of our gem specs does it specify, you know, that those are gems that work that we use or what versions we support. It's just like at runtime needs to be in your gem file.
Right.
And so do you do runtime version checks?
Yeah. I mean, we just do like we just call gem at the top. The first line of the PostgreSQL adapter is gem PG greater than or equal to 0.18 less than 2.0.
Gotcha.
And then require PG. And that works fine as long as it is in your gem file. But it's just one of those, like, it'll blow up early. You know, it blows up when your app boots. But it's just one of those, bundle should have failed.
I ran into that. I don't remember what it was. I think I was trying, while I was preparing the migrations talk, I was trying to, like, test out MySQL or something. And so I just, like, switched the adapter to MySQL, not thinking, like, oh, I obviously also have to gem install the MySQL 2 gem. But like, then I just ran the app and it exploded like that. And I was looking at it. And I was like, why didn't Bundler? Oh, wait, because I didn't do anything with like, this is just weird. Like,
speaking of MySQL, I have recently been going through the deep, deep pain of moving from MySQL 5.5 to 5.6. And every single one of my Rubies, I've had to recompile my MySQL gem because they got compiled against the system MySQL. And so if you try to connect to a database at a different version, it just won't connect. And like for a while there at Dio, we had transient MySQL versions in production, and this is a nightmare.
Right, because their wire protocol's not stable.
Right, it changes between like minor versions of MySQL.
Yeah.
I just saw that MySQL went from 5.7 to 8.0.
Sure.
What's the story there? What happened to 6 and 7?
Java versioning. You go 1.4, 1.5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
So basically, Percona and MariaDB is what happened. There were ideological conflicts over what should happen with major version 6. And then I thought it was going to be 7, and I guess it's 8 now. But there were then also ideological differences around what should happen with major version 7. And so, you know, PHP did the same thing. They were like, PHP 6 will happen when we solve Unicode in the language. So they released MySQL 7. It was the same sort of thing. But basically, if I remember correctly, MariaDB is MySQL 6. And I guess just out of respect, they skipped that major version.
Wikipedia says, work on version 6 stopped after Sun acquired MySQL.
Right, and that's when MariaDB forked.
There's another product called MySQL Cluster, which uses the version 7. And then when they needed another version number, they decided to avoid the confusion with MySQL Cluster 7 and jump to 8. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
But you're saying you're getting all sorts of issues just going from 5.6 or 5.6 to 5.7, Sam?
Yeah, basically, I try to connect to a database in Ruby and it immediately exits with client version is 5.5, server version is 5.6. We refuse to continue.
Oh, yeah. That's awful.
Yeah. It's almost like versioning your wire protocol separately from your client and server versions is a good idea, and continuing to accept connections from older client versions is a good idea.
Who'd have thunk it?
It wouldn't be a huge issue if it were just like, at work, I write one application and I need to connect to its database. I'm like, oh, okay, I guess my client version needs, but like where you're connecting to several different versions of databases, that's a problem.
I mean, distributed microsystems architecture, my friend, that's how you build a web app.
Unfortunately, by what I heard from people speaking about it at RailsConf, you're right. So.
Oh, really? I did not go to many distributed system talks.
I didn't go to many of the talks. I just heard lots of people talking about like microservices and stuff like that.
Sure. I will say this. I think the theme that I've observed most recently is people speaking at conferences about how their Rails app got too big, their team got too big, it was painful to work on. And so instead of doing microservices, they did something else. And like, I always cringe at the something else because I'm like, you have actually just ruined your Rails application.
Or they can just do like traditional SOA. There is a middle ground between monolith and microservice that isn't terrible.
Right. But like, try explaining nuance to people on the internet.
Sure.
So that middle ground being like, you don't have to have like a user service, an account service, this service. You can have like more meaty things than that.
Yeah. For example, a service at Shopify that's always been somewhat-ish isolated, more so than other things, is shipping.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
And we also have a team called shipping, and the shipping team works on the shipping component and pretty much is able to just work on that one piece of it. That's where I think like SOA done right happens, is where it's less of a technical choice, it's an organizational one, and your service boundaries are drawn along team boundaries.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. The advice I give people is when you have a Rails app and you feel like you're having trouble working on it, is what's something small you can identify and split off easily and then turn that into a service.
I'd also like to clarify that services don't necessarily have to have HTTP boundaries between them.
Sure, they can have gRPC boundaries between them.
You know, it doesn't have to be over the network. It can be a process boundary I know some people like to use Rails engines as a separation and even keep it in the same process.
Yeah, I put that in the category of you have ruined your Rails app.
I agree that it's probably not the greatest thing to do, but especially as an intermediate step, I think it makes a lot of sense. Assuming that you're not going to do a big bang rewrite.
Yeah, the thing I'm actually more interested in talking about is like why doing services is hard is like a meme, because it is, but like the way people think it's hard is not the way it's hard. So like a lot of the things I think people struggle with are like stories around, well, what do we do if this thing is down? Like, how do we make sure these things are talking to each other correctly? What's a good thing to split off? And like, there's good writing about all of that, but it's not bounced around the Rails sphere at all. as far as I can tell, actually. And so, like, now that I work with a bunch of Go programmers mostly, and we're, like, just knocking services out all the time, like, we do have problems, but they're not, like, ones of architecture. It's more like, how do we ensure that every component in this fleet is reliable and the requests are going the right way and that sort of thing?
Right, but I mean, network requests do fail.
Sure. And like, you have to no matter what. Deal with that.
Right. And that is the thing, right? Is now you do have to say, like, how does my app work if the auth service responded with a 502?
Don't extract auth. Like, step one, don't extract an auth service.
But you know what I mean? Some piece of it that you need that to be up in order to continue.
Sure.
Which, I mean, Amazon is one of those nebulous, everybody knows they do SOA and it's probably right. Well... But I mean, it is one of those things where if, you know, significant chunks of Amazon can be down and you just see less stuff and it's fine.
Right. Partial responses, degraded availability, like doing something intelligent, fetching from a cache. These are all options that are right. I guess a thing I would be interested in is what does convention over configuration look like for doing services?
Yeah, I agree with you that there are solutions. I think maybe... Because, like, everything you just said, like, yes, you can do those things. Those things are hard.
Yeah, but so was... I mean, to pull from Eileen's keynote, right? There are many things that used to be really hard that Rails has now made really easy, right?
Oh, yeah.
We apply that same mentality.
Yeah, no, I agree. Let's make action service a thing. I'm sure DHH will love it.
I don't know. I'm more partial to, like, the people that I see exploring... service-oriented architectures or microservice-oriented architectures don't need them and see them as a cure for a problem that they definitely have but are the wrong solution for.
Yeah.
Like, in most cases, it's like, we've made a complete mess of this code base. We need to prevent ourselves from making this mess again.
I completely agree.
And so, like, they create several messes instead.
So I have a take on this. Most people... in the past who have built Rails applications do not need to do services at all. Their Rails applications are too small and their teams are too small. Agreeable so far?
Yep,
I'm with you.
However, if you believe that it is more likely that your company will be a crazy runaway success on Ruby on Rails today than it has ever been in the past, then like there will be more companies of size like the Shopify's, GitHub's, DigitalOcean's, etc. of the world who have huge code bases and have huge teams for which doing services is appropriate. And so, like, and actually, this is, again, to borrow from Eileen's point, we are independently inventing solutions to these problems, but could they be in the light of day? Could Rails have a way of doing this? Because that's the way it's going, right? You're going to have larger companies on Rails with larger engineering teams doing more complicated things. And, like, it just seems like a very natural solution to the problem to me.
So let me ask you this, though.
Uh-huh.
Because services are much more popular in Go, and people talk about how much easier it is to build it in Go, except
sure.
That really doesn't seem like that's because Go has so much there that's super helpful. Like, Go doesn't have anything that will help you, you know, with degraded availability.
Well, it's an ecosystem thing, right? So, like, if you look at where the Ruby ecosystem comes from, right, it's teeny tiny startups, solo founders, maybe a few more than that, like, building web applications, testing and iterating quickly. All of our ecosystem, everything in it, is sort of optimized and well-built for that context. I mean, you can literally see Rails has grown up with Basecamp growing up as a company, if you like that analogy.
Yeah.
Go, on the other hand, literally comes from Google needs college students to be able to build reliable distributed systems all the time, right? And so there's like, it's not a language difference. It's like an ecosystem and tooling difference. And that means that we can borrow those parts of the ecosystem and the tools to like, make improvements. It's really, to me, it's more about the conversation and the culture than it is about any necessary technical impedance.
Okay, that makes sense. One thing I do find interesting in Ruby land, and I guess it's really not just Ruby, but I the threshold that is acceptable seems to be higher in Ruby, like exception levels, and that level being greater than zero. So, like, I'm not saying that you should never serve any 500 requests ever, or your application is terrible, but I think people allowing even as much as 0.5% of requests to be 500 or anywhere even remotely close to that is sort of insane, and yet that seems to be, you know, somewhere between 0.1% and 0.5% seems to be the threshold that, like, we consider acceptable in this little chunk of the industry.
Sure. I don't have an opinion on how often an application should 500, I guess. Never.
Right. Well, that's what I mean. Like, crates.io, we are 500, other than when there was an incident and I got paged. We've had 0 5xx requests in the last week.
Well, doesn't your Rust compiler make the overwhelming majority of those impossible?
Yes.
Cool. So,
or at the very least, it forces us to handle them.
Right. Give some reasonable error response. And I actually, this sort of comes back to my ecosystem tooling idea. Much of the tooling that Ruby gives you does not make it glaringly obvious how to deal with errors that can happen, right? So, like, a good example is Faraday. Do you put rescue Faraday client error literally everywhere you make a Faraday call? Because if you miss one of them, that's a source of exceptions, right?
Right.
And so, like, this is actually something I experimented with, where we wrote a tiny wrapper around Faraday, which rescues that error and, like, forces you to pass success and failure procs, and then evaluates one of them based on whether or not an exception was raised. And so by doing that, right, you're sort of hacking the programmer's mind and forcing them to deal with that error. And we found that the exception rate on controllers that use that client instead of Faraday directly went way down, right?
Yeah.
And so the point I was going to make is that, like, in languages like Go and Rust, you are forced to deal with errors, right? They're weaved into how you're programming. And I actually do think this comes back to this conversation about microservices in Ruby, is that if you're doing more things that are prone to failure, such as making HTTP requests, then we need new tooling that, like, is better for dealing with that, right?
Do you need new tooling or do you need a new language? Like, what do you mean by new? What tool would make that easier than, like, it seems like other languages are just better designed for that.
So I'm not sure I agree with that. Okay. I think Ruby is perfectly well suited to doing that. It's just that no one has really developed tooling that works in that way. Like, the success failure callback is a really good example of this, right? Where you take your path, your params, what to do with the response and what to do with an exception. And, like, you can't not pass all four of those, right?
Right. Yeah. I like that a lot better than some of the other proposals, like with result objects, because
yes,
result objects only work in Ruby for things that return a value.
Mm-hmm.
And there are so many places that can fail, like calling .save, where it doesn't have a meaningful return value, and it's super easy to just accidentally ignore
sure. The
result object.
And actually, you know what no one does? No one rescues, like, the myriad of failure conditions between their application and the database. Right.
Right, because they're making the assumption. I mean, I don't necessarily think that they should. Like, in most cases, you're making the assumption that, like, my application layer has validated that this is valid, and so I expect it to save. If it doesn't save, I really don't know what to do. I just 500 is an appropriate response, right? And it's not until you get enough of those where it's like, okay, 500 is not an appropriate response here. How do I want to handle this?
Yeah.
I mean, it also depends on, like, if it failed because, oops, the database is down. I mean, first of all, one thing that you could just do is retry the whole request.
Right.
I guess one common way it would fail that you would definitely want to do something about is when you have a uniqueness constraint and you have a lot of things being created at the same time, right?
Right.
And Rails, yep. In the next major version of Rails, will introduce a way to kind of, you'll instead of calling find or create by, you call create or find by or whatever, which helps solve that problem. But
sort of, except... It doesn't, because the big issue there is that it opens you up to a different kind of race condition, and if that one fails, it just aborts your entire transaction. Another way to put it is you can't do this inside of a transaction because, right, this one tries the save first, and then if the save fails, it tries the find.
Oh, right.
If the save fails inside of a transaction, your transaction is now aborted. You cannot make any more queries until you have rolled back the transaction.
Sure. In most cases, well, I don't know, I can't say most, but if you are aware of that condition... You can make that call. Like, I'm just thinking of, like, a standard controller where you're creating a user or something like that, where you're not going to be doing anything inside of a transaction other than, like, I'm creating one record. That makes sense. And in cases where I'm trying to think, yeah, it's going to be an issue more than I would think.
One of the things I want to do is if Rails is willing to drop support for Postgres versions less than 9.5, or at least only support this feature with Postgres 9.5 and up, for Postgres specifically... And actually on MySQL too, we can actually solve this by doing on conflict do nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And then insert ignore on MySQL and insert or ignore on SQLite.
Provided cool. That you're willing to live with the fact that things that differed outside of your unique key or unique index wouldn't get updated.
Yeah,
which
but
I guess
that's
is true of find and create by. Right, yeah, it's already true.
Yeah, you're going to lose the second one regardless, right?
Yep.
You know, I mean, then we could just do upsert. But as I think we discussed last week, right, upsert is really, really impossible to abstract over in a way that, like, works on every backend.
Yes, we did discuss it, and I will take your word for it.
Well, I didn't hear that discussion because it hasn't been released yet, so yeah. Fine.
Just imagine it being amazing.
I'm sure it'll be wonderful.
Give us a Reader's Digest version, Sean.
The Upsert-esque capabilities of the backends that we support are fundamentally different in a way that, like, we can't, it's not even a question of providing a common interface. What they can or cannot do is different in incompatible ways.
Cool. And you can't abstract over that with carefully constructed transactions?
Not while retaining the actual semantics of Upsert, no.
Okay, cool.
I mean, we can, it just then becomes non-atomic, and that kind of defeats the whole point.
Upset. So, Derek, REST yes. versus GraphQL.
I love GraphQL.
Yeah? How's it going?
I haven't done a lot of it lately since I rotated off a project that was using it, but, like, I explored it with other folks, and every time I see conference talks on it or whatever, there were a number of conference talks at RailsConf that I don't think I saw any of them because I had other things to do, like record many episodes of a podcast, but I think there were at least 3 or 4 GraphQL talks or workshops, right?
We had so many GraphQL proposals this year. So I was on the program committee this year. Mm-hmm. It was definitely the single biggest theme that you could identify in all the proposals. And yeah, it seems really in the moment.
And it seems to be deservedly, it's not just I don't think it's just a, whoa, this is cool, let's do it. I think it actually does solve a lot of problems for people that people are experiencing. I do worry that as somebody who gave a talk on REST, basically extolling its virtues as a way to let it guide you toward good code, uh-huh. we need to recreate all of those conventions in GraphQL land.
Sure.
And that scares me a little bit, particularly as it in regards to doing GraphQL in Rails apps. I don't enjoy the experience of the GraphQL Ruby implementation because it's not, it's mm-hmm. DSL heavy with no underlying object model at this point, although I know it's on their radar of things to provide, where I'd really just rather write classes. And maybe I don't think I'm in the minority from the number of people that I've talked to. It's I kind of just wish this was classes. But, I don't know. So in Ruby land, I'm a little less excited about it as I am just as a whole, the idea of GraphQL overall. How about you, Sam?
Yeah. I have not actually done any GraphQL, but I have recently been playing with a new database called dgraph, which is a graph database, and it presents an API that they call GraphQL Plus, and it looks an awful lot like GraphQL, but it basically supports special functions for querying over their graph. And yeah, I sort of get the idea of I have these things and I want their relational these things and then go through there. But you also have the ability to say recurse to leaf nodes or find me the shortest path between these two things and then attaching GraphQL style queries to all of that. And I've been finding it very enjoyable. We're actually wrapping this in a gRPC layer because of course we are. See the previous podcast episode that I was on. And yeah, it's nice. Also, graph databases are cool.
I'll just take your word for that. I haven't used a graph database, I don't think, ever. But I am looking at the dgraph. We'll link to this in the show notes, and there it does look very, the query language looks very GraphQL-y.
Yeah.
There's some things that are I don't recognize here, but other than that.
Yeah, it's so the problem we have is there are various ways in which users can be linked together at DigitalOcean. So this user referred that user who paid with this credit card that was also used by this user that created a team, and then sort of recursing through links. And so we found it was impossible to express certain things that we were trying to do with a SQL query. The query would be very, very big and complicated and recursive. And so, yeah, it's been great high leverage for us to reduce the complexity of how much code we have to write to find out information about our users. It's a little beta-y. We've had some problems where network partitions occur and transactions deadlocked and whatever, but the team from dgraph seems to be working on that really well. It's definitely new.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we compared it with Neo4j, and we really liked Neo4j, but in order to be able to do online backups with Neo4j, you have to be able to buy an enterprise license, and we were not interested in doing that. So,
aren't you guys an enterprise?
Sure. Basically, we didn't want to invest that much money until we had proven the concept a little bit more, and at that point, it was easier to switch underlying database technology than do that.
Sure. No, and I think for a graph database, I mean, GraphQL as a basis for the query language, which makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
I mean, they both have graph in the name, so you'd hope. Right? You would hope those things go well together.
I don't really see, like, GraphQL, when I'm using it with a relational database, to be, like, a graph database really much at all. Maybe that's just my limited experience with it, but, like, it's just a way to query a database to me.
So the thing is, right, if you do a very recursive GraphQL query, you know, like users into teams into users into teams into users into teams,
right,
that's going to create a huge join.
Yes, exactly.
On your database.
Yes.
Whereas, like, with a graph database, it won't. Right. So, like, you can express queries in GraphQL that will get translated very inefficiently on top of a relational database.
Yes. Fair.
And actually, this is one of the biggest points I remind people of when they talk about GraphQL, is that, like, if you're using it as a straight replacement for, like, Rails and RESTful, it's usually very easy to reason about the number of joins a RESTful endpoint is going to do, and much harder to do that with a GraphQL query.
I just want to mention, like, users into teams into users into teams, like, you can just do that with a recursive CTE very easily.
Great. Sean, how do you express a recursive CTE in Active Record?
Find by SQL with CTE.
It's funny that, like, you say find by SQL. It's funny because if by the time this comes out, people may have seen DHH's, if they weren't at RailsConf, may have had a chance to see DHH's keynote where he talks about, like, I don't ever have to write find by SQL anymore. And, like, I spent all week this week in my client work writing custom SQL strings, like, not full find by SQLs, but writing custom joins and writing, like,
yeah,
I do that all the time. So I don't know what kind of app he's writing, but I find it hard to believe that there's no find by SQL, but I find it hard to believe there's no custom joins or anything like that.
My thought there is that you can pretty much express any join that you would like with Active Record, right? It's just that at some point you're doing gymnastics and it's much faster to write the SQL expression if you're good at SQL, right? But there are probably a whole army of developers who aren't, who can do the Active Record gymnastics.
Or I think in my case, it would be Rubyland gymnastics, because, like, often when I find I want to do this, it's like I have it basically boils down to what I want there to be is a parameterized scope.
Sure.
Or a parameterized association on this user, for instance. And so mm-hmm. I want to take the current post or whatever and join it to authors, but I want to join it to authors with a condition on the user. So I want, like, to join on, you know, a.id equals b.aid and something else. And I can't
just do that in the where clause.
You can, unless you're doing something like you're left joining for the purposes of saying I want to find all the records that don't have an associated record over here, because your where clause then needs to be where, you know, the joined in record ID not null.
Sure.
Yeah. Yep. Or something like that.
At which point, yeah, I would argue you could then just do, like, a sub select in your where clause, but at that point you are still now dropping down to SQL, so that doesn't help.
Right.
Well, wait, you can put a relation in a relation, right? Like, I can pass a fully formed relation into a where clause, right?
Yeah, you can.
You're not supposed to.
No, I mean, it's supported. It's public API. What you really want isn't even where not in. You want where not exists, and that you can't express with public API.
Right, but I do that all the time by saying where, and then I pass a relation, and then I call arel, and then I call exists, and then and it works just fine.
You can totally do that.
And that's
how
you can
also do. You can also do just do is not null, right, instead of exists.
Right. Well, that requires you to have done it as a left join.
Sure, I do left joins all the time.
Right, but then you have to. That's what we're talking about. Is then you have to drop down to SQL to do your custom on clause.
Right.
Because that if you're going about it that way and you have a secondary condition, you do specifically need it to be in the on clause if your where clause is going to be where the right side is null.
And for whatever reason, on this project, I just keep having to do that thing where I'm like, I want to find all of the records in X that don't have an associated Y. And it's like, oh, okay, I keep having to write this thing again. And I really wish I could call joins and pass, like, an additional condition to tack onto the joins or something like that.
Yeah.
Well, so, I think we just came up with our feature request for Rails from the episode.
We'll send it to Eileen and we'll make...
Like, there's a super obvious API for this if relation is not a thing that exists. Like, if there's an object that represents a table, then yeah, you call .on that. Mm-hmm. And then that's super obvious and you pass that in. If there's a way to express a fragment of a where clause other than a hash or a thing that represents an entire query, like, the problem is with Relations API, there's no obvious way for us to introduce a pleasant syntax for expressing what you want in your on clause.
What if that was a dot table method on the active record class?
Sure. I mean, yes, there is.
And there is
private API, and it's kind of shitty to use.
What if we made it a good public API in time for Rails 6, Sean?
Yeah. Time for Rails 6. Yeah. Good luck.
He did say we, so I think he just volunteered to do it.
I mean,
with your tutelage. So there you go.
The main thing is still just decoupling Relation from the rest of Rails to the extent that we can move it to a gem.
Because
we can't even begin to explore alternate query builder APIs unless we're able to swap that, because I'm never going to deprecate Relation. Like, that needs to continue to work until the end of time, because there's too much Rails code depending on it. That's not going to migrate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
Did you have anything else that you quickly wanted to cover, Sam?
Quickly? Gosh, I don't cover anything quickly. am I allowed to say that we're hiring?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so DigitalOcean is hiring for a bunch of different engineering teams. It would be wonderful if you could join us. You can check out our jobs posting on our website. It's good.
If you want to join another team, you can go to thoughtbot.com/jobs, where at present, I think there are 26 different job openings or something like that. So check out that site and apply to jobs, please.
Cool.
And then if none of those suit your needs, then I guess you can go see DigitalOcean. But
and I guess I'll stick a link to the Shopify jobs posting in the show notes. We've got like 170 something openings right now.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us, Sam. If people want to follow you, they can follow you on Twitter at Sam Phippen, correct?
Yes.
All right. Do so. Show notes for this episode can be found at bikeshed.fm.
As always, ratings and reviews on iTunes are much appreciated.
If you have feedback on this episode or any of our other episodes, you can tweet us at _bikeshed, email us at hosts@bikeshed.fm, or leave a comment on the website.
Thanks for listening to Bike Shed, and we'll see you next time.
This podcast was brought to you by ThoughtBot. We are experienced designers and developers who turn your idea into the right product. With local studios in Boston, San Francisco, New York, London, Austin, and Raleigh, let's build something great together.